So you ready? 2019? Here we go. Whew. What's it going to be like? Not sure. Better than last year? Yeah, okay, I'll vote for that. All in favor? Okay, God, you know where we are. Yes, and who knows what 2019 is going to be. I guarantee you this, a year from today, we will be 1 year closer to the return of Jesus than we are now. So that's always good news, however long or short that time's going to be. Often on the first day of the year, I will do a vision message and talk about visionary stuff, cast vision and that kind of thing. And usually it's pretty general, and I move towards scriptures like where Jesus says, you will do even greater things than these, and talk about how we can, because the church is worldwide, we can do more than Jesus could do to spread the faith in one spot, and those kinds of ideas. But that's not this time. I am talking about vision, but I want to be very specific this time. But first, I want to talk about what's not working, okay? So, Larry, would you put up the first bridge picture? Now, this is a bridge over the Chulateca River in Honduras that was built by the Army Corps of Engineers in the 1930s. It's a really nice old-school suspension bridge, goes way over the top of this river, and it's pretty much a one-laner, although it looks like if the cars aren't too wide, they might be able to squeeze by. And I think in the years following when we built the Panama Canal, there was a lot of desire to connect Central America to that shipping lane, and it was kind of part of the payback for letting us have the Suez Canal for pretty much a century, and then, of course, we gave that back to them at the turn of the century about 18 years ago. But there was a problem. There was this idea, it started in the 60s, and then it came back towards the end of the century, and that was the Pan Am Highway. Anybody remember that dream of having a highway that would, a four to six laner that would roll from Alaska all the way down through the west coast of Canada and North America and through Mexico, through Central America, and all the way down to the southern tip of South America? And the idea was you could get on the Pan Am Highway and you could run the entire length of North and South America. And so that idea came back, and Honduras decided, you know, each country had to build their section of it, kind of a little bit like I-70 runs from one side of America to another, but each state kind of tries to decide what big towns and what areas they want the big highway to run through for economic purposes and trucking lanes and things like that. So they commissioned a wonderful six-lane bridge, and a Japanese firm actually got the bid, and they said, here's the deal. We get hammered here in Honduras with hurricanes. We get smacked around all the time. We need a guarantee that you can build a bridge that can last against a Category 5 hurricane. And the Japanese were, oh, sure, we got that. We can build a bridge that will last even a Category 5. And so the Japanese engineering firm went and they drilled deeper than anybody had ever drilled before to find solid bedrock. And they built this unbelievable six-laner. It took quite a while to build. And when they finally got that up, it was like the biggest, most expensive, and strongest, hopefully, bridge in all of Central America. 2 years later, Hurricane Mitch hit. Category 5 by the time it hit Honduras. Over 400 people died in Hurricane Mitch. And the flooding on the Chulateca River was impossible. But guess what? Show them the next picture. The bridge survived. That's the bridge at the bottom. There's no road on either side of the bridge, but the bridge itself lasted through the Category 5 hurricane unscathed. But what else is wrong with this picture? The river doesn't run under the bridge anymore. The hurricane moved the bridge, the river, over to the side, and now the bridge doesn't go over the top of it anymore. So they had a problem because the bridge they built no longer connected anything to anything. Now what are they going to do? And why do I bring that up? Because that's where the church is today. Not just our church, but the church in America in general. We have built a bridge, but it doesn't connect much to our culture. It's not like it's a total non-connector. It's not like there aren't some people. But for the last 100 years in America, the church has largely adopted an attractional approach to getting people to come to church. We build a nice-looking building. We put signs out that advertise, and we'll put special signs up on the corners all the way around our church with little arrows pointing to. And we have a building, and we practice welcoming people and connecting with them after we attract them in. And sometimes we'll do some high-profile community stuff like an Easter egg hunt or a Halloween deal or something like that. And we'll try to connect with the community and get them to come in so that they can see what happens on Sunday, because that's where we really want them, is into the mix of the church's prayer life and the church's experience of Jesus Christ. Get them in here and connect them to Jesus. So we've tried being attractional, and that model actually has worked fairly well until the last couple of decades. It's been pooping out. It's a bridge that ain't connecting to the culture very well anymore. And so today I want to talk specifically about, because Larry, give me the third picture now. Here's the new Google Earth, and the part alongside the land, that's the old bridge that is now connected to the new bridge that runs way over the top of that river and goes quite a ways. So they used the old bridge and added onto it a whole new bridge in order to get the transportation they wanted, and I'm saying that's what the church has to do now. And I want to talk today about, well, what is the model? So when I'm praying, after I saw this wonderful bridge parable and realized, gosh, that's kind of a picture of us, what's the bridge we connect the attractional model to that gets us into our culture? And so I'm thinking, well, what was the best time in all of church history? What was the time of the greatest growth? It was the first 200 years. It was the early church, whoever that was out there. Yeah, it was that time. And guess what? They didn't have buildings. They didn't have buildings. Sometimes they when we saw that, we last summer on Wednesday nights, we watched a series on that first 200 years. From Christ to Constantine, it was called. It was the first 300 years of the church. And one of the things we saw was the oldest church building that still exists. And it was built in a cave in Antioch. It was the first place where the term Christian came from. And it was just a few walls and some furniture inside of a cave. So still the attractional model wasn't even in place. And we learned from that thing that several places around the world, as the church got going, they went into caves because they were often persecuted, and that was a safer place to meet. So the last thing they were going to do was throw up a church on the corner and say, hey, everybody, we got that Christianity thing, come on in. But that's what we do in America. And it's understandably why, because I can remember when I was 10. Did I just hear somebody chirping? We got a bird? That would be fun. Anyway, with this hearing aid once in a while, I pull in a few things, you know. Police car going by, you never know. But anyway, where was I? So we have the attractional model, but what was their model if it wasn't the attractional model? Because that's the last thing they wanted to do, really, was draw attention to their meetings. So here's what we learned from that series and what we learned from history that they did. They served people. And they served their communities so well and so indiscriminately that it began to break down barriers. And what do I mean is, if people were starving and they could find those crazy Christians, the Christians would take care of them. And they didn't care if they were Romans or if they were locals or whatever they were. And they didn't care if they were high mucky mucks in the upper stratosphere of the nobles and all that, or if they were just the slaves and that kind of the lowest. They didn't care social strata. They didn't care economics. If you were hurting, they were going to try to be there for you and take care of you. And what happened was, when the big persecution came, when the one guy who was ruling over that fourth of the kingdom that included Rome, when he really decided, I want to kill these guys off because they're threatening the favor that we should be getting from the Roman gods, the communities had trouble supporting that. The military supported the persecution, but the communities, as the Christians died with valor and courage in the arenas, began to change their thinking. And they thought, they're the ones who were there when I got flooded out. They're the ones who were there when a place burned down. They're the ones that were there when Dad died and we didn't have any breadwinner in our family. They took care of us. If we crush them out, we're going to miss them. We kind of like those guys. And in fact, I'm starting to think their God might be better than the Roman God that I keep putting food out in that temple and it just rots and nothing happens to it. I mean, so they served their way into favor, and it was the time of the greatest growth. And Paul set that up in this scripture from 1 Corinthians chapter 2. So let me read this to you. We've kind of seen it already, but here it is again. Though I am free and belong to no one, I've made myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. Now, think about that. Paul's idea was spread the gospel through slavery. That's pretty dramatic language. But he's not talking about enslaving people and forcing them to believe. He's talking about enslaving the believers to the non-believers voluntarily. And he doesn't just say serve, he says slave. He uses very dramatic language. And of course, slave in America is even more dramatic than slave was in many parts of the world, because slavery has such a bad taste and such a sting in American hearts, because how long have we stumbled over all of that racial junk? And so here he says, look, I make myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. To the Jews, I became like a Jew. And of course, he was the ultimate Jew early in his life. He kept the law. He'll tell you right in his writings. I kept the law better than anybody else. If anybody has a right to brag, I do, because I kept the law. I did it all right. I followed all the stuff, and I was the best Pharisee I know. And so if anybody had the right to say they could earn God and earn heaven, I, Paul, had more of a right than anyone else. But then he'll say, but I count all that rubbish so that I could know Jesus Christ, the real way to get there. So to Jews, I became a Jew to win the Jews. To those under the law, that would be the law that God gave Moses, though I myself am not under the law, so as to win those under the law. So, okay, I'm meeting with guys who are trying to keep the law, and I want to connect with them, so I'm going to eat kosher stuff, and I'm going to do all the kosher Jewish things so that I can approach them and not put them off before I get the chance to tell them how they can be set free from trying to keep all the rules and just believe on Christ for salvation. But I'm not going to chase them away. I'm going to do that with them. Chapter 9? Yeah. 1 Corinthians chapter 9? Yeah. Thank you. Okay, so if anybody was looking for that in chapter 2, oops! Let's see. To those not having the law, I became like one not having the law, though I am not free from God's law, but I am under Christ's law. So he says, I'm not throwing out the law. We learn a lot about God's opinions and likes and dislikes and how he expects us to be from his law, but we also realize from his law that it's impossible that we could ever perfectly keep that in any way. But I'm under Christ's law, which is, he kept the law for me, and now his blood is the sacrifice that keeps me in right relationship with God. So as to win those not having the law, Gentiles, to the weak I became weak to win the weak. I have become all things to all people, so that by all possible means I might save some. So we got to realize we're not going to get everybody with any technique. We're only going to get some, but this is the way the early church functions. They enslave themselves to non-believers. So get a little uncomfortable now, because I'm going to talk about us enslaving ourselves to non-believers today. It got real quiet. And then he says, I do all this for the sake of the gospel that I might share in its blessings. So he's going to enslave, and that's what we see the church doing. They're persecuting us, and we're blessing them as they do it. We're praying for their health and welfare as they kill us off. We're in the lions are being released and coming after us, and we're praying blessings upon the people who are turning the lions loose. And we took care of their kids. They had an autistic child, and we worked with that kid and tried to bless him. And we tried to take care of the people in our communities. The desperate people know that we are their friends, and we take care of them. And that spread Christianity. They went from nothing, from a few stragglers, to 10-15% of the Roman Empire. And that's the fastest percentage growth in the history of the church. And 10-15% may not seem like much, but I remember from sixth grade American history, it only takes 10% of a population to win a revolution, to overthrow the government and win. It only takes 10%. Our forefathers, the Revolutionary War guys, you remember what they called the Americans who still wanted to stay English? They called them Tories. They were the bad guys. They didn't want to go along with the revolution. And some of them would even fight for the British. But the 10% won the day. The guys, but they were a sold out 10%. They were the guys who suffered and died of disease in Valley Forge. And did you ever study the Battle of Princeton? It's amazing. They're in Valley Forge. They haven't won a single battle in all their time. And all of a sudden, George Washington thinks, you know, these guys are camping out over there in Princeton. Yeah, the seminary Ivy League school that would become the Princeton we know today was a seminary with some other college classes then. And the Hessians, the German soldiers that were being forced to fight, they were being kept in those barracks over Christmas time. And Washington thinks, we got to have something happen. We got to win one. We're going to sneak across the Delaware River in dead of night, and we're going to hit them at dawn. And if you read the writings and the letters written home by the soldiers who fought in that small skirmish, the numbers that he was able to generate, he decided, I'll cross here and you guys cross down on the other side of the town and we'll get him in a pincer movement. And the guy he put in charge of the other guys, they got down there and they looked out the river and the guy says, Washington's crazy, we're going back. And they never attacked. They didn't even attempt to go across the river. He blew it off. And Washington's guys, keep in mind, they've been fighting for a while now. Some of them didn't have shoes. And it was snowing heavily. And there was frozen ice in their feet. They could follow the trail by the blood from their own feet as they approached the river. And Washington, if you study it, you'll find he had them throw sawdust into the beds of the rowboats that went across the river so they wouldn't slip on their blood, so that they could row and not slip off and get in and out of the boat without slipping because the blood was so thick. Some of them had stuff wrapped around their feet. And finally, and they can only have a few boats, and it's ice flows, chunks of ice going down the river, hitting the boats and stuff. They finally, after hours, get all the stuff. And there was one guy, I love this guy, because he was in charge of artillery. And Washington said, we can't take artillery across. This is like a guerrilla tactic. We're just going to slip across the thing with guys in muskets, and we're going to hit them by surprise. And this guy says, I'm the artillery guy. I'm taking a cannon. So Washington's like, okay, you can have one cannon. but you're the last ones across. He says, no, I'm going across first with the cannon so I can hold everybody off. And Washington's like, okay, fine, take the cannon across. So this guy wrestles. He gives him one boat, and he and his guys, they get this one cannon the other side. They have to take it off of the wheelie thing because they can't get the whole thing on at once, take the cannon across, and then bring the wheels across and the axle. And he gets that all set up, and now he's going to end up waiting for almost 6 hours for the rest of these guys to make it across in a couple of boats. And he falls asleep on the riverbank and gets frozen to the riverbank. And the guys have to bring in shovels and pry. He gets up and he's got all this moss and dirt stuck to his backside because he fell asleep and froze to the side of the riverbank. That's a serious case of frostbite. But that's how exhausted he was. But he had his cannon. And so Washington, they worked their way through the woods, and sure enough, right at daybreak, and the soldiers, it's Christmas Day, the soldiers have been celebrating a little on Christmas Eve, the Hessians have been celebrating a lot on Christmas Eve, they're sloshed, and then the few guards that are out there, they take that place in 10 minutes. And the Revolutionary War has its first great victory. And it took them a whole day to get back to Valley Forge. But they won a battle, and it resonated around. Now, I tell you that because that's commitment. That's enslaving yourself to a cause. Those guys were slaves to the revolution. That 10% was slaves to the revolution. What I'm saying is we have to make ourselves slaves to win some to the loss. The service model is the second half of that bridge. That's what, I'm not saying throw out the attractional model. I still think we should be good stewards of the building and grounds and take care of it and make it look as nice as we can and all that wonderful, great. There are always those people who will still come in just to see what's going on because it looks like a nice place and stuff like that. We don't throw out the old bridge. We add on to it service model now, the best model for the church, to win people by serving them. Wow. Why did the South fight so hard not to lose slavery? Because they didn't think they could get by without them. Their whole economic system was built on that. When you serve people well enough, pretty soon they feel like they can't get by without you. And then you've won the right to tell them about Jesus Christ. So on our Friday night prayer sessions, I've been taking notes the last couple of months. Here's what I think is the way we can enslave ourselves to people. We need a couple of meetings outside of Sunday morning that we can invite people to. And we have some already. But the kind of meetings not where I talk and everybody listens, but where everybody talks and listens and shares their stuff. We need one, probably one for younger folks and one for older folks. So that'll be introductory to meet a handful of people who are regulars at the church, but not so many that they can't remember all their names. A small group where older and younger folks can come in and begin to share lives in exchange. That's going to be important no matter how we connect to people, that we have those things to invite them to. Now, there's a church in Longmont. And when I was at New Life, we're the biggest church in Colorado. You know, we were kind of threw that around because we were all that. You know, we up over 10,000. For a little while, New Life was the biggest church in Colorado. But there was a pretty good-sized church, 6,000-7,000 in Longmont. And we kind of competed some with them because we had our Easter production called The Thorn. And it got so popular that I can't say his name now, the guy who wrote it, he would travel the thorn around and put it on in different churches all year long. It got to be a whole thing that he did for a few years. And we had our Easter production, and we had ice skaters and dancing to Walking in a Winter Wonderland, and we did all of that kind of stuff, plus sacred stuff too. And we put on productions, and at one point we had the thorn hit Drew. Over the nights we offered it, over 50,000 people, and it became the single largest attended event in Colorado. But these guys had a thing that they started off with a living nativity in Longmont, and each year they added more to it until it got huge. Now, they were outside because their church was right on the edge of farmland. And the farmer was a member of the church, and after he harvested and plowed, they could use all these farm fields. They didn't just build the nativity scene, they built Bethlehem. Each family would build something that was part of Bethlehem, and some would be merchants trying to sell things that they figured out people sold in marketplaces in the times of Bethlehem. And they even tried to have a bit of the wall of Jerusalem in a gap before you got to Bethlehem, and they had Roman soldiers bossing people around. They actually had 3 camels with the wise men, real camels that spit and everything. And so they had this projection, and people would bus in from Texas and Oklahoma just to see their thing there. And then their leadership about 12 years ago started being convicted in prayer that they're throwing away tens of thousands of dollars, and what are they really achieving except to encourage some Christians to get all excited about the birth of Jesus, which is not a bad thing, but could they do more than just be the best act on the block? Well, one of the members of their church they were trying to adopt a foster care child. And this is Boulder County. Longmont's in Boulder County, most liberal county in Colorado. When they went in for the interview, they said, oh, we're strong Christians and we want to raise this kid to know Jesus. And Boulder kind of went, it's a little uncomfortable for us, you know. I mean, it's okay if you want to go to church yourself, but we're not sure if we want him being adopted by somebody that's determined that he's going to have to be a Christian. He ought to be able to make that decision for himself. You know, you can see how the wheels were grinding. And the leadership was impressed by that situation of that couple and how because they were thinking, who's a good Christian lawyer that could represent us in this thing? Because it's not against the law for people to be strong, practicing Christians and want to adopt a kid who has no family. In fact, as Christians, we kind of like to think that might be the best possible family with the family values. And so they started going, yeah, this is right. And so they began to study the foster adopt system in Boulder County. And they realized it was heavily underfunded and they were struggling. They had a lot of kids. There weren't a lot of people in Boulder who wanted to adopt some kid that was born addicted or something like that. And Longmont's really the only other big population base. But the values were coming out of Boulder. So what did they do? Hire lawyers and attack Boulder? No. They started to fund foster adopt. They started to put the money not into the Christmas thing, but into supporting those kids in those foster situations while they looked for adoptive parents. And Boulder started going, wow, this church in Longmont's really taking care of business. They're making our lives easier. We're starting not to feel quite so bad about them now. And they did hire some lawyers, but they didn't go to attack them. They hired lawyers that could learn the system, understand the laws, and coach up Christian parents from their church to know how to approach the adoption procedure and be successful. And so then they used those lawyers and they started to search beyond their own church for Christians who couldn't have kids and really wanted to adopt. For the last 7 years, there have been no foster adopt kids in Boulder County. They get adopted as soon as they come up, and 90% are adopted into Christian families. That is serving. They served the county of Boulder and changed the way adoptions happen. Last I heard, they were trying to go statewide with it because it's very hard to foster a kid and then adopt them without spending tons of money to make that happen. It's just really expensive. So they decided that's it. And now they have fruit. They have those kids in their church as young adults going to college and born again. And they can say, that's a better place to spend the money. They served. They became the slaves of that system until they served it so well that they earned the trust of Boulder, which is a town I grew up in. So that's no small miracle, but it wasn't so much a miracle as it was doing what Paul said to do and applying in a practical way. And I believe, because God also said, our church is perfectly positioned to do something also slavery-wise. to enslave ourselves. So I started brainstorming with those guys on Friday night. We don't have tens of thousands of dollars to try to change foster adopt in Arapaho. How can we enslave ourselves to people to win some to Christ? You know what we have? We have about 4 educational experts that are really strong in special ed kids. There was a Lutheran church that used to once a month offer church for parents who have special ed kids, and they had their people trained to be able to handle those emotionally disturbed and kids who were born addicted. They specially trained to be able to do all of that. And once a month, those parents, because you know what happens to them most of the time, they drop the kids off, and about the time you hit the second song, so they're getting the bzzz, bzzz on the buzzer, and they've got to go and take care of their kid because he's bouncing off the walls, and they got 5, 10 other kids, and they can't have that kid disrupting the whole class, and they're not ready for it. Christy's got a degree in it. I've got background in it. Nancy, that's what she does. And Judy Fryer has background in it. So I'm forming a committee, the 4 of us, plus whoever wants to join us, and see if we can do a similar thing, because that Lutheran church is letting go of it, from what I understand. And what a blessing it would be to those parents once a month to be able to go to church and stay in church the whole time and have confidence that there's somebody back there who understands their kid and can handle whatever comes up for an hour and 15 minutes. That's a desperate family, and we can be their slaves. But that's not all. We live in the most culturally diverse county in Colorado and probably in all of the western states. You've got to get out to California before you find a place as culturally diverse as Arapaho County. There are 20,000 Ethiopians alone in Aurora. And that's just one African country. How many immigrants are there totally? You know what they're desperate for? How to speak English. Well, I should say how to speak American, because American and English are practically two different things. What was it? Mark Twain said it's two countries separated by a common language. But the point is, and interestingly, Chrissy happens to be getting a degree in TSL, which is teaching second language, English as a second language, to kids who that's not their first language. And she was telling me, you know, they don't actually need the formal reading and writing thing. What they need to start with is conversational English. Just teach them how to say some things. And that, you know, that's how people go in a foreign country. How do you say that in French? Okay, oh, that's chapeau, that means hat. And then you say, le chapeau, something, le chapeau pour la moi. You know, and you start putting together some very awkward sentences and you begin to speak a language. And that's what they need. And they're desperate for it. And only about 10% of them are Christian. We could serve them as their slaves and teach them our language. We can do that. Anybody in this room can do that. Can teach, and there are simple to master curricula to help us be well-rounded in teaching conversational English. Free! Free! If you attend here. No, just free. Just free. And become their slaves. You see, those are specifics. That's what I'm talking about. What if we're there a year from now? What if we're able to convene 10, 20 immigrants on a regular basis and love on them enough so that we can introduce them to Christ and tell them this would be a nice place to practice their English skills? We've had a few people occasionally who join us because they're trying to learn English. And so, yeah. I'm not saying it so we can grow this church. I'm saying it, though, so we can grow the church. Because I'm assuming most of them are going to want to attend a Christian church that speaks their native language. But we could be their church home away from home. We could love them and serve them until they value the church enough to go to one, even if it's not us. And in doing all that, Jesus takes care of us. So I'm talking some real specifics. I've already talked to the committee to look into the special ed thing. And I'm curious to know who could see themselves teaching English one night a week, or maybe it's afternoon. We'll see what the best times are to do that, so that we could put on our sign free English lessons and a phone number and see who we get. Because now we're talking about being servants. We're talking about adding to the attractional model, the servanthood model, which was always the best one. In America, just kind of, not totally, there have always been churches that fed the hungry and did those kinds of things. But for us here, there was a time when we used to host a truck before I got here that came up and gave everybody a basket and they could go through the truck and pick out groceries and that kind of stuff. I've heard people who were here before I was talk about when they used to have that big semi-truck park out there. Claudia was involved in that. Well, it's time for us to get involved. And those are just two things coming out of prayer that we might do to reach folks. English classes, special needs. Another thing that I'm talking with Jason about and playing around with is a podcast. Allowing people outside of our church to ask questions about the church and doing what I do here with questions, only doing it as a podcast with their questions. Because as untech savvy as I am, fortunately some of you like Jason are, and I'm aware that people, like the guitar guy that came in today, and he said to me, I went up and said, hey, welcome to our church. I knew that Matt was bringing a guitar guy. So I said, hi, and he said, oh, you must be the pastor. And I didn't even have my tie on yet. And I kind of gave him a look like, how'd you know that? And he goes, I recognize your voice. And I said, yeah, I got on your website and I listened to some of your sermons. I really like the scrubbing bubbles. And so there's a real power in social media. And if that's where the bridge also needs to go, if there needs to be an on-ramp into social media, that's so much better. We do have a reasonable website. But I'm aware that sometimes we take for granted that we all understand what we're talking about. We don't realize somebody coming to the website doesn't know. And we tend to only advertise the things that are open to the public. And so we don't put explanations of all the stuff we do in detail. We could be better at that. We have a much stronger website with much more explanation so that somebody new to the church says, well, now, what's that Christmas thing that's coming up? How does that work? Do I have to sponsor a table or can I just be on a table? How do I get at a table? And do I need to bring some food? Oh no, does the person at the table pay for my $10? Or do I pay the $10? And none of that's explained on our website. We need that kind of stuff, right? And maybe a podcast would be fun too. Not all enslavement is egregious work. Some enslavement is life-giving. I tell you, you can't walk out of the urban outreach and step back out into the cool, clear air at night without feeling like $1 million. Just because for the last hour and a half, you work your tail off and you serve some people who you were able to bless some people. And that's just a good feeling. If you struggle with anxiety or self-concern all the time, go do that, and all of a sudden your world feels 10 times better, and you're grateful. And anyway, this is the model. This is the one we need to plug into. I'm going to explore the couple of things I've talked about, and I'm asking anybody who wants to jump in on any of those or other ideas that will come up about how we can enslave ourselves, other people, let's let them all come, okay? Because my prayer this year is that next year at this time, we can see that we put feet to some of those things and it's yielding genuine fruit, okay? So let's add to our attractional model. Let's continue to greet people and be warm and invite them to the smaller gatherings. Let's get a couple of gatherings that are specifically aimed at connecting those people to some of the nicest people I've ever known, the people of our church, and begin the process of sharing life at a gut level with them as they grow into those groups. And then let's try some of these things. My trash can is filled with ideas that didn't work and always will be. But this is really based on Scripture. And it's based on a better model than what we have. So we've got the $1 million bridge, but we need to add the second half now. And we can serve. And all of us can do that. and not just filtering through once a month on First Thursday, which is the 7th of February, but looking at engaging in some of these things where you might actually fall in love with some brand new people as you teach them English, or with families that desperately need a chance to go to church and realize you love their kids. I'm told that they also would have a special Christmas party for the kids, just for those kids. Something about that feels all right to me. And it came out of the First Friday prayer group, which if you haven't been to that, you should, because it's just powerful. And even Don came. So and not that Don, that Don. So anyway, now we're going to approach this table. And what it's going to do is it's going to remind us that this Jesus who paid that terrible price to pay for our sins so it wouldn't block us from knowing him, this Jesus is also the head of the church, and he has a plan. And if we embrace his plan and listen to him in prayer and hear what he's saying, because that's where all this is coming from, then we'll step into his plan and we will be the best version of his church that we can be. Amen? All right. When we have communion here, we practice open communion, which means that anybody who believes in Jesus Christ as the Son of God, who died on the cross for their sins and was raised on the third day, anybody who believes in him in that way, then they're welcome to join us. And if you don't, then come up after the service, let this pass by, and come up and pray with me, and I'll pray with you, and then I'll give you the communion once you've accepted Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior. Amen? All right. Deacons.